good afternoon. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Kathleen Dunn Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Facebook was full of fake news during the most recent election. My guest, reporter at Foreign Policy Magazine, says that the proliferation of fake news and social media prevents us from having a coherent and honest debate about national politics. And he's calling for an all-out offensive on media literacy education. What do you think about that? You can get in touch at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, talk@WPR.org, or find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook. Let us know what you think about all the controversy over all the fake news, not just on Facebook, but all across social media. My guest is Ilya Lazovsky, an editor at Foreign Policy Magazine, dedicated to covering political and economic transitions around the world. He joins me on the Kathleen Dunn Show today. Ilya, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Program. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, John. Thanks very much. Very happy to be here.
You start your piece with a Walter Lippmann quote. There can be no liberty for a community which lacks the means by which to detect lies. Lippmann was, he was a skeptic, particularly about the ability of the average citizen to detect lies. Would that still be true today? I mean, how capable are we of figuring out what the truth actually is?
Well, Lippmann was writing in the first half, mostly, of the 20th century, and unfortunately, he was already skeptical then, but I think the problem has only gotten worse with the rise of social media and of fake news on social media, which I think are actually two separate problems. And unfortunately, even if the outright fakery somehow was eliminated, which could be possible, I think we'd still have the problem of people only sharing content and reading content on social media that's shared by like-minded people. And it diminishes our ability as a democracy to come to some sort of consensus on what the facts really are in our political debates.
When you can't agree on the facts, it's really impossible to have a debate.
Exactly. We all know that in a democracy, people have different values, and we've argued about those forever. But at least we used to have gatekeepers, the nightly networks, the major newspapers, which were healthy, the news magazines, where everybody got a common store of facts, and then we could all argue about how to interpret those facts, what to do about them. Now it seems like we don't even have the same common facts. We live in different universes, and it really just makes it impossible to even have a conversation, even to have a rational debate, which I'm afraid people are going to find out Thanksgiving dinner, if they don't know already.
and there'll probably be a lot of Thanksgiving dinners where certain topics are just not talked about. They just don't come up because everybody knows what will happen next.
Exactly.
That works until about the time that the third bottle of wine is opened. We're talking about, I mean, the journalism is the so-called fourth estate, has a significant role to play in a democracy. I mean, creating an informed electorate has been the job of journalism since the beginning of the founding of the country. I mean, papers were around then, but there was fake news then. I mean, there's really nothing new under the sun here, is there?
Well, in a sense, that is true. But there are standards of professional journalism that have developed over hundreds of years, and those still exist, actually. There's a common sort of argument that, you know, journalism is all terrible, it's all lies, you know, the mainstream media, all of this, and maybe that's what has been misinforming our electorate. But actually, this election, even this election, has produced a great amount of really high-quality journalism. And if it is the usual culprits, you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post, NPR, of course, all these different sources have done great reporting on both candidates, exposing flaws in both candidates. It still exists, and it's there. It's just being completely drowned out because people don't want to share these nuanced, detailed takes. People want to share what makes them feel good. It gives them a hit of dopamine to signify their identity, whether it's Republican or Democrat or something else. And it just drowns out, you know, these fake and very biased Facebook pages, for example, get, in some cases, much more shared much more often than something more nuanced and more professional.
Well, we're all looking for validation of our point of view, and it's easier to get now than ever because anybody with an internet connection and a keyboard can call themselves a journalist. How do we sort the sheep from the goats, as it were?
Well, I think this is a very difficult problem. I think we have to start by all recognizing that it is a problem. There are basics in fact-checking, in reading a source and figuring out, is this trying to con me? Is this trying to only present a certain point of view? Is it presenting the opposing argument? Is it name-calling? You know, there are sort of basic features of aspects of media literacy that we can teach, and I think we should be teaching in schools from a very young age, much more so than we are now. I'm not super hopeful that that's going to happen immediately in schools around the country, and even if it does happen, I'm not sure it can withstand the really strong impulse on social media to just share what makes you feel good. But I'm afraid it's maybe our only chance. I wish I could sound more hopeful. It's a really difficult problem, but at least we should start by acknowledging it as an emergency, and it really is one.
800-642-1234, the number to call to join the program. What do you think about all the fake news? And we certainly had a lot of it. Lots of clickbait headlines out there, and I know my Facebook feed was full of that, and I actually stopped following people who seemed to only post that kind of stuff because I just, you know, wasn't, it was just kind of cluttering up the my news feed, and I think a lot of people started doing that. Was there a fake news story this year that really stood out to you as maybe the best example of what we've been talking about, one that made you particularly angry, or maybe it made you laugh or possibly even cry?
Well, this one has been cited in a few places, but I found it striking myself. It's the one about arguing that, or claiming that the Pope had endorsed Donald Trump for president. And, I mean, it's difficult to believe on its face, but it is, in fact, not a true story. But the striking thing is, I don't know exactly how many shares it got, but it was hundreds of thousands. And then there was another story on Snopes.com, which is a fact-checking website, which debunked that story. But that debunking only got, you know, maybe 30,000 or even less. It got much, much less shares than the fake story. And this is, you'll see this again and again, that stories are debunked. You know, the professional journalists are doing their job, but these kind of fake stories just spread like wildfire. It's really astonishing, and I find it frightening, and I think we all should.
Well, one of the things that's happened here, though, too, is that as soon as people started consistently posting things from Snopes or PolitiFact, we started to get a wave of stories about how, well, Snopes and PolitiFact are biased, and here's why, and they're supporting this candidate or that candidate, and so we can't trust the fact-checkers either.
That point of view does exist. I mean, everyone can read the fact-checkers and make their own judgment about whether they're being fair. Certainly, probably in some cases, they have their own biases, but everyone has their own bias. It's just, it's whether an outlet is attempting to be professional. And in this election, many of the stories reporting on the fake news phenomenon have found that, in fact, on the Donald Trump side, there was more fake news. It existed definitely on both sides, but somehow, for whatever reason, on the Republican Donald Trump side, there was more of it. And if the fact checkers are going after that, two people who support Donald Trump, it may seem that the fact checkers are more against them. And that's an artifact of where we're finding the majority of fake news today.
We have an email from Dave. Here's what Dave writes. We should call it what it is, propaganda, misinformation. He says, he says misinformation makes it seem more kind. He goes on to say, I want to bring up how the Bush administration and Republicans in their attack on our education system through No Child Left Behind, when this program was enacted, it eliminated all critical thinking lessons and reasoning skill lessons, leaving these kids, now adults, unable to determine when someone is lying. He said, she said arguments mean no one knows what the truth is. He says, I wanted to get your guest's thoughts on that.
Well, I'm certainly not an expert on No Child Left Behind or on the education system, but I do think, you know, there's many have observed a tendency that education is more and more geared towards testing, standardized testing, and these sort of formulaic curricula, and that may be a problem. I really am not an expert to comment on that. I do think, however we decide to move forward with reforming our and improving our education system, that media literacy should absolutely be a core part. I mean, this is just as critical as basic math, you know, and reading. In our democracy in the 21st century, we're going to have a lot of problems. We're going to be in big trouble if our citizens can't distinguish truth from fiction.
Well, and if you can't pick out, if you don't know what logical fallacies look like, it's pretty easy to be taken in if you don't know what to look for. Of course, a lot of clickbait is pretty easy to recognize. I mean, look for headlines with words like destroyed, humiliated, and in all caps, jaw-dropping. I mean, there's a whole list of inflammatory language that we see in clickbait headlines, and that's always a red flag. Real journalists don't write headlines like that. But how do we fight back against this? What are some things we can do?
Well, some people have started coming up with sort of technological solutions to this problem. Maybe if technology is the problem here, maybe we can find a way to use technology to solve the problem, or at least to help. So there are sites that you can go to. I think one is called Burst, where it sort of encourages you to engage in dialogue with people who believe, you know, who are your political opponents or who disagree with you on politics. There's a really interesting little experiment that the Washington Post did where you could enter your county or your zip code, and then it would show you the closest county that voted the opposite of yours, maybe suggesting that you could go for a drive and go to a diner or wherever, you know, it may be, and start talking to people. I had an idea that maybe we could do some kind of internal study abroad program of some kind where high school or even younger students could spend at least a semester or some amount of time in an area of the country that's very different than theirs. You know, one thing we found in this election is how differently our cities voted compared to the rural areas. That's really one of the key divides in American politics today, across which we're finding it increasingly difficult to talk. Why not encourage students, when they're still young and they're still forming their political opinions, to spend some time in a part of the country that's very different than theirs? What if this kind of program was universal? You know, what if it was well-funded? What if students who couldn't afford to do something like that were given financial aid? What if it was mandatory even? Maybe that sounds radical, but I know from experience that there are educational initiatives like this, semester schools, that allow students to have that kind of experience, and sometimes it can be transformative. So maybe that's at least a first few steps in addressing this problem.
Well, and you know, I guess one other thing that it might be interesting for people to do is to, for example, listen to the BBC, find out what the coverage is like from the vantage point of Europe. There are a lot of English language editions of European newspapers that are available online for free. You can go and read them and take a look and say, oh, that's what they're saying about us? Well, you know, maybe that's worth thinking about. It seems like there's, if a person really wants to be informed, there certainly has never been a time when we've had more information at our fingertips than right now. I mean, we have the ability to find out what's going on if we really want to.
That's true, and it's sort of a paradox because, you know, all this fake news, all this biased news, no one's forcing anyone to read it. I think we just have to cultivate, this is the most difficult thing, cultivate a feeling of responsibility among people that if you read a story that makes a claim, that you should investigate what could the opposite side of that claim be. I think, you know, I've tried in my life to cultivate a practice of following people on social media who I completely disagree with on every topic. I make sure I look for smart people who are making honest arguments. That's important too. But it's really important to burst that bubble and to expose yourself to opposing points of view, even if you find them abhorrent, maybe. I think we really just cannot get through this without starting to try to understand each other. Mm-hmm. So whether it's a foreign source or a domestic source that might have a different political alignment, I always tell people, read the basics, that really the New York Times, the Washington Post, the large newspapers, they really do a great job. They might have biases here and there, but at least I think that's where you have to start. Maybe that's my own bias talking too, but...
Well, we're all human beings, and we all have points of view, and they do influence what we do and say. So, I mean, let's just start there. The idea that we can have a completely unbiased human being is, well, it's just not possible. We need to take a break, and so we'll do that. And when we come back, we'll have more with Ilya Lazovsky and your phone calls. Phones are full right now, so you'll get a busy signal if you call 800-642-1234, but do not let that discourage you. Send us an email, talk@WPR.org, or you can post your question or comment to the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. More to come. Ilya Lazovsky with Foreign Policy Magazine is here. We're talking about the flood of fake news, not just on Facebook, but across the spectrum of social media and pretty much everywhere. We're just inundated by it. How do we have rational discussions about important issues of public policy and politics when we can't agree on the answer to the question, 1 + 1? If we can't do that, then we are in trouble. We'll talk some more about that this hour on the Kathleen Dunn Show. John Munson in for Kathleen today on the Ideas Network of WPR. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this Thanksgiving Eve. This hour we're talking about how Americans are awash in a sea of disinformation on Facebook and elsewhere this past election season. And joining us on the discussion this hour is Ilya Lazovsky of Foreign Policy Magazine. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Let's take some phone calls. Ben is with us in Chicago. Ben, hello. Welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Yes, good afternoon. I kind of had a couple things that occurred to me that I don't often hear mentioned in these kinds of conversations. For example, one, the abandonment by academic study of the potential for human beings to achieve some concept of objectivity in what they're learning, or at least to strive for it. There's much that's done in terms of the academic process that tries to convince people that there are no such thing as facts, only values, in a certain sense, which is ridiculous, but that seems to be the way a lot of academic work is going. Second thing I wanted to bring up that I also think is rarely discussed is the sort of corrosive role that the ascendancy of business school graduates with MBA degrees coming into positions in nonprofits and government and also in journalism have done through their rather inappropriate management practices being applied with things that have completely different goals than what would be true for a for-profit business. And even then, in those cases where you are dealing with a for-profit business that has a public interest component, this idea that we have a concept of public interest that demands a higher standard of conduct has been eroded severely, I mean, probably beginning with the FCC losing the fairness doctrine. I think there's, you know, a part of where we could be educated to have better, you know, media literacy and criticism skills. But at the same time, I think we also have to be critical about our environment and how it has changed in these aspects that I've mentioned.
Ben, thanks. Thanks for the call. Ilya Lazovsky, lots to chew on there.
Well, on this, I certainly, especially on the second point, agree that we need to have a conversation about how we have sustainable media in this country that serves, you know, a public good. The problem, you know, the caller mentioned business school graduates. The problem is that a lot of our media sources are for-profit businesses, and above all, they feel an urgency to remain profitable. And it used to be much easier before the internet, before the rise of social media, than it is now. So maybe we do need to have a conversation about what kind of media we can have that can survive as a business. Some of these practices become, the social media contaminates the traditional media because the traditional media finds that more and more of its viewers are driven by social media. So they start adopting these same clickbait practices and it degrades their own performance. You can understand it because they're trying to survive as a business and so many media outlets have failed or have shrunk and reduced their coverage from around the world and certainly it's a huge problem. Your caller is absolutely right.
Well, and at the same time, we now have a 24-hour news cycle. I mean, you have 24-hour news channels on cable and on the radio, and they have to fill that time with something, and it's a lot different than when you say, let's say you've got, say, 20 to 22 minutes in the evening newscast, and you cover the most important stories there, and then maybe local reporters come on for another 22 minutes of actual content, and it's even less if you take out the sports and the weather, and you compress the day's news into that or onto the front page of a newspaper. It's a lot different when you have to fill 24 hours a day with news, and you have to keep people's attention. You need headlines. You've got constant graphics all over the place. You want to, you know, there's a lot competing for our attention these days that wasn't there, say, in 1968 when Walter Cronkite was the most trusted man in America.
And part of the reason they're getting so desperate to keep our attention is because an increasingly large percentage of our news and political conversation is not even happening in those venues anymore. It's happening online. So at the same time, they're getting desperate. They're trying to adopt some of these not very public-minded, you know, practices. And it's just another example of the change that has happened because of the rise of social media. That's why it's such a difficult problem to solve, because what are you going to do? You can't get rid of it somehow. So we have to figure out a way to work within it.
Well, Facebook and Google have announced that they're going to crack down on fake news sites. I guess we'll have to see how that works. I don't know exactly how they'll do it, but they apparently have people they pay quite well to figure stuff like this out. Do you have any hope that this will actually take place, that we'll see less fake news going forward?
As far as the problem of fake news specifically, yes, it seems that Mark Zuckerberg has gotten the message from the avalanche of criticism that he's been under and Facebook has been under. I think that problem can be solved if there's a will to do it, and I hope they do. I think the larger problem, and much more difficult, is that even if you got rid of all the fake news starting tomorrow and snapped your fingers and it was gone, the sort of bubbles that we're in where we're sharing news that's not fake but that's definitely misleading or biased or just reinforces our identities, that's not going to go away. And it's hard to envision what Facebook could do, even with the best intentions, to combat that. That's what I'm most worried about. The fake news is just the first step.
Well, here's an email from Dave. And Dave sounds a little bit discouraged, but I'll read what he says and then you can decide. Here are Dave's words. Post-election, my first move was to basically remove myself from Facebook and Twitter. I decided that they were simply hardening my bubble, and I'm a person who was already making an effort to seek out diverse opinions and legitimate news sources. But even so, it was almost impossible not to get sucked into ideological, homogenous content. Changing the Dave goes on to say, post-election, well, Dave's discouraged, and he's basically bailing on social media because he says it just hardens his bubble, and he was somebody who was reaching out. What advice would you have for somebody like Dave?
Well, Dave, I'm sorry to hear that. On the one hand, go Dave. He's recognizing the problem. On the other hand, it's sad that a thoughtful person who's interested in hearing the other side has just disappeared from Facebook, leaving it to more different people. I can't recommend that people quit Facebook. I use it myself all the time. It's a great tool. It's a great way to keep in touch with our friends. I mean, it's just such a part of our lives now. I just don't think you're going to build some kind of movement around encouraging people to quit. So I hear that discouragement, and I think probably it's coming across in my own statements as well. I think we just have to focus on education. That's the only thing I can really think of. If anyone's got any better ideas, please write a book. Please make it happen. I'm trying to sound the alarm here. A lot of other people who know more about this than I do are doing the same.
Okay.
We need to do something. I don't know exactly what.
Dave, thanks for your email. Let's take another phone call. John is with us in Madison this afternoon. John, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Hey, Ilya, John. Happy Thanksgiving to both of you. Thanks for having my call. I just wanted to, and I guess you guys have already touched on this while I was waiting, but I think it's remarkable, this whole thing about fake news. And I think people are sort of searching for real news because they go to, Hearst broadcast apps that are filled with, oh, check out the puppies that were rescued from a car today, and check out this, non-news story, feel good, whatever. and there's not enough real news because, like you said, these corporate conglomerates, these media corporations, are sort of searching for profit wherever they can. I've actually worked for one of them. But what I find remarkable about the whole thing is I don't think it took the Internet for this to happen. I think it was, the Telecommunications Act of 1996, which Bill Clinton signed into law, that sort of allowed for FCC deregulation of cross financial interests, mergers, things like that, corporate influence in media. So I think it's all really disappointing, and I think there's a giant flow chart essentially that starts in the 1990s, and it's sort of manifesting today with more and more technology. I hope that made sense. But thanks for taking the call.
John, thanks for sharing your point of view with us. Ilya?
Well, I really can't speak to the deregulation that the caller mentioned in the 90s, just not being an expert on that topic. I do think he's right that it didn't start with social media. I mean, criticism about the nature of news was criticized when it was starting to be on TV. You know, Neil Postman, the well-known media critic, was lamenting the rise of, he wrote a book called Amusing Ourselves to Death, which I mentioned in my piece, which criticized the rise of television as a source of news. Now we're talking about, when we all watch the same networks and had the same facts, we're talking about that as something that's better than what we had now. But it was already being criticized back then, that it just couldn't be as substantive, that it all turned into entertainment. It's really striking if you watch an old presidential debate on YouTube from the 80s, or even the early 90s, how much more substantive it was than what we get today. I think that's part of the problem. It's just getting more, it's reality TV, it's not substantive, it's not high quality discussion. So it just keeps happening, it keeps getting worse. Wish I didn't have to sound so pessimistic. I just am really alarmed.
We could have a whole show on media regulation, and I actually am an expert. I have taught courses in mass media law at a university, and so I do know something about it. But yeah, that's not really what we're talking about today. Certainly a factor, media concentration, the drive to always make money. And from a journalistic standpoint, isn't it true? I mean, there are basic types of stories, and some stories are really easy for us to digest. Sports scores, stories about, tomorrow's weather forecast, or puppies. And then there are stories that really make us work. It's sort of a delayed, there's an immediate reward versus a delayed reward. I mean, don't you think sometimes that stories that make us think, that have implications beyond the next 10 seconds are stories that we would all just like to avoid, and it's gotten really easy to do that?
Absolutely. And I think that's why, I try not to moralize about this, and I try not to scold people and say, stop reading the puppy stories, start reading the serious news. It's just a basic fact of human biology. Our brains know how they feel about something first, and then they rationalize afterwards. So we're being trapped by our own biology here, and that's why it's so hard to do something about it, and that's why people avoid challenging news, and it's especially painful to read news that contradicts your own opinion. There was an experiment that someone did where, I think it was a British outlet, where they got American liberals and conservatives to switch Facebook feeds and to read news only from the other perspective for a week, and it was striking how difficult most people couldn't even get through it. So it's something very basic to our human nature that we're trying to fight here, and that's why it's so challenging. But we have to figure out how.
Okay, John. Thanks for that call. Let's go to Anita in Lindenhurst next. Anita, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And tomorrow I'll have one more thing to be thankful for. This show today, I really, really like hearing this vocalized. I have one comment, and then I have a question for your guest. The comment is, I don't go on social media at all. I have a real, real skeptical attitude towards it. I can see its merit, but it's not for me. And what I've observed, it seems like people have gotten, their brains just won't allow them to invest the time to do what you were just talking about, and that's to go into the deeper aspect of a more important story. If they can't grasp the whole thing in the headline and 1 minute, they're not interested. Just tell me what I should think. is what I'm observing. They just want to be told what to think. They don't want to weigh the opinions. And, you know, you've got young people that if I mention a newspaper, they've always been in the digital age. And so they look at you and go, newspaper? What's that? And they know what it is, but they're just kidding, you know. But they aren't really kidding because they don't pick up a newspaper. It's all digital all the time. So, you know, how much they're really discussing politics amongst themselves, even at the university level, I don't know. People are afraid to disagree with each other, and they're afraid to disagree online on social media because they might lose some, quote, friends. They may be unfriended, and honestly, I find that really hilarious. My question is this about the media. All through the election, I longed to hear anybody in journalism do an investigation as to why Donald Trump was not revealing his income tax information, and he still has not. You know, where are Woodward and Bernstein? Where is that today? Is it what your guest was just saying, that at the corporate level they're not allowing the journalists or funding them to do such things, that it's too chancy? You know, as far as profitability goes, I couldn't figure it out. I feel like in journalism, it should be more than just reporting. There are people that do investigate. And why was that in particular not investigated?
Mm-hmm. Anita, thanks for the call. Ilya Lazovsky, you say in your article that that reporting does take place and that we had some great examples of investigative journalism in the last election cycle. But I think the point you're making is that it just basically gets drowned out by all the other stuff. What do you say to Anita?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think there is great investigative journalism that is being done, that was being done. I know I keep harping on the New York Times and the Washington Post, but they just had some great long stories on everything Donald Trump, from his, you know, stiffing of contractors to his business practices. They reported on his taxes. Maybe they didn't get it exactly the reason, you know, the reasons that Anita was referring to, why he didn't reveal his income taxes. We can all guess maybe some reasons, but there was a lot of investigative journalism, and I'm just afraid it didn't reach enough people. There was a separate problem that sometimes these constant, you know, WikiLeaks revelations about the Hillary Clinton's campaign sometimes tended to sort of drown out the Donald Trump coverage, and I think that comes from an effort to be fair-minded and cover the faults of both candidates, but it turns into this sort of making both candidates' flaws equivalent to each other, which I think, dispassionately observed, cannot be justified. And there is a whole separate problem of the TV news, you know, giving Donald Trump so much free coverage to the detriment of more critical, in-depth reporting, such as what Anita was really hoping to see. If you seek it out, I promise you it's there. The problem is that only a tiny percentage of people will do that.
Anita, thanks for the call. We're at a break. When we come back, we have more phone calls. And there'll be a place for you opening up just momentarily at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org is the email. And you can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave a comment or question there. Ilya Lazovsky is my guest. He's an editor at Foreign Policy Magazine, and he wrote an article that was the genesis of this program. We're kind of talking about how fake news is a huge problem right now. It was certainly in the last election cycle, and what we might do about it. And as we go to break, I'll just a listener sent in this famous Mark Twain quote. I'll leave us with this as we go to our break. Twain wrote famously, "A lie will go twice around the world before the truth gets its boots on." I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to this program on the Ideas Network of WPR. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on this Thanksgiving Eve. We're talking this hour about how Americans are awash in a sea of disinformation on social media. And joining us to discuss this issue, Ilya Lazovsky of Foreign Policy Magazine. And you, if you care to join us at 800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org or on Facebook. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Let's take another phone call. Ann is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to say that I completely disagree with your guest's main point. I find that social media, in fact, hold the mainstream media feet to the fire. And I'd like to give you two examples. One is the blackout on WikiLeaks coverage and Guzford II coverage when the DNC leaks first came out. And what it really showed was a collusion between the mainstream media and the DNC. In particular, the New York Times, Maggie Haberman was a person they could feed stories to. They edited stories in the New York Times, and Glenn Thrush from Politico sent them a story and literally said, "I know I'm a hack, just edit this and send it back," which is completely, the opposite of journalism. A second example is in CBS on Charlie Rose interviewing Bill Clinton. He asked how often Hillary had these kinds of collapses, and initially Bill said frequently, and then changed it to, well, occasionally. And they completely cut the frequently response out, not only in the video, but in the transcript of the video, which I find egregious. So I'll say let's keep social media, keeping mainstream media feet to the fire.
And thanks for the call. Ilya?
Well, I think we have a disagreement here. Respectfully, I would just say that the WikiLeaks coverage has been misinterpreted, and it's easy to seize on that kind of stuff because it's scandalous, it's salacious, you know, it's leaked, so people want to talk about it. And, of course, there was a lot of social media chatter about the content of WikiLeaks. And first of all, I would say that there was a lot of mainstream reporting on WikiLeaks. It was in the major newspapers. It was on TV. I mean, you're hearing about WikiLeaks everywhere. But a lot of the communications that were just alluded to were of sort of misinterpreted. It was journalists trying to communicate with members of the campaign, and if you take certain quotes out of context, it can sound like, you know, that I'm a hack, which I didn't read that myself, but I think it was maybe said sarcastically. Certainly there are things to criticize there, and Hillary Clinton's flaws as a candidate were out there, but this is an example of how professional coverage of an issue like WikiLeaks is drowned out by more sensational coverage of WikiLeaks. And I know the caller will disagree with me. I think we're not going to resolve that right now, but
what about her point?
Exactly what I'm referring to.
What about her point regarding Charlie Rose?
I'm just not familiar with that episode, so I'm afraid I can't comment on that. Okay. Maybe, you know, in this case, she would probably say, aha, there you go. Social media is pointing out the omissions of the mainstream media. Sometimes that can be true. And maybe there is a balance to be drawn here. And it's difficult to come to a consensus here.
Mm-hmm. Let's go. Anita, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Megan, who joins us from Milwaukee. Megan, hello. Welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Hi, you guys. Okay, so here's my comment. I'm 36, and so I've lived through all this crap, the rise of Facebook and corporate media and all this stuff. And what I notice on TV when you're watching, like, whether it's Fox or CNN or MSNBC, which is basically the three basic, or the three big, you know, cable channels, it's not even that it's 24-hour news. It's that it's four, maybe five stories that they play over and over and over and over again for the 24-hour cycle. They don't talk about anything else. Like, there's 25 other things going on in the world that are extremely important, but they only focus on four or five stories all day, every single show, hour after hour after hour. And it's not even, I don't even know how you can call it news anymore. It's more like entertainment media. And then some of these people are journalists, but maybe, like, I think Rachel Maddow does a pretty good job of investigative reporting on her show. But other than that, I don't even know if these people are, you could consider them journalists. Like, it drives me absolutely nuts that everything is breaking news. Like Trump speaking in Pennsylvania, breaking news. Hillary Clinton boarding her plane, breaking news. Like, that's not breaking news. Breaking news is a hospital being bombed in Syria or something like that. It's sick to me that so many people are watching this. And the day I decided to not really follow my Facebook anymore was the day that the story about the Pope endorsing Trump came over Facebook, and I was like, all right, I'm done. Thanks. That's my comment.
Okay. Megan, thanks for joining us. Megan's point about, there's four or five basic stories we get all day long, and it's not just the reporting on those stories. It's also we have the story, and then we have to have 15 or 20 minutes of some pundit or groups of pundits explaining what we just saw.
Absolutely. I am in complete agreement. You know, I don't like TV news. I try to avoid it myself to the extent possible working in a newsroom. I don't watch it at home. This is where we have to get a little bit nuanced, because actually the internet, including social media, does give us an opportunity to seek out these other important stories that these networks aren't going to cover, whether it's Syria or, you know, my own magazine, Foreign Policy, of course, covers all these issues abroad that often don't get enough attention in the United States, and you can use the internet to seek those stories out. There's wonderful journalism and blogging from on the ground, from in the U.S. and around the world, and there is an amazing wealth. You can't just condemn it all. It's just a question of how we select that. I think we have to teach people to seek it out, because it's definitely there. That's the problem. It's available, but are people going to read it?
William in Arthur, Wisconsin is next. William, we'll take your call. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Well, thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because, where do you get accurate news? The government lies to us just about every chance they get. Half the stuff, between the unemployment rate, the rate of inflation, everybody knows, we've got better than 1% inflation, for crying out loud. If you pay bills, you know that. And then, don't you think it's a shame that we get our most accurate information from places like WikiLeaks and Edward Snowden, John Harwood, and clearing questions with Hillary's committee? And then you get to the Washington Post and New York Times, where the anti-Trump, it might have been investigated, but these stories ran 20 to 1 against Trump. When it's that slanted and that biased, it just seems like it's a lost cause to get accurate news from any of the reputable news sources anymore. What they say is accurate, and the politicians, we will give it spin. They call it spin. Is that a nice way to say, well, we'll turn this on its head and say things that really aren't true, but it sounds good. Anyway, that's about all I have to say. I don't go on social media at all. I do read a lot of blogs and stuff, and you get far better news from them than you do from your newspapers, your televisions. The media is owned by four corporations or so. They decide what's news and what's not news, and what are these people too stupid to hear? Anyway, thank you for listening.
All right, William. Thanks. Thanks for your call. William started with this. The government lies all the time. Something that we've really kind of gotten a drumbeat of in the last 30 or 40 years or so. The government used to be considered fairly trustworthy. Politicians were assumed to not being always truthful, but the government itself was fairly trustworthy. Have we gotten to the point where we just don't trust government at all?
Well, what I heard in that call was a lot of discouragement again, distrust of distrust of the government, and he distrusts the mainstream media, which he sees as left-leaning and biased against Donald Trump. I think this is part of this wider phenomenon that these institutions that used to sort of be seen as the pillars, anchoring our democracy, at least in some level of truth, are seen as discredited now. I think a lot of that is driven by the rise of these alternate sources, which like to stir up distrust of these institutions, and the Donald Trump's campaign certainly took advantage of that, and all of these sites that we've been discussing, not just Facebook, but blogs, as the caller said, they relish in tearing down the New York Times and the Washington Post, and I just can't. All I can say is it's not the same standard.
If someone says everybody knows, isn't that kind of a red flag for you?
That's exactly the kind of thing you might expect to see in a headline in one of these fake Facebook stories. I'm afraid that this call was a perfect example of the sentiment that this kind of environment creates, and it makes me very sad.
Leslie in Chatfield is with us next. Leslie, hello. Welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Hi, John. What I see as a problem is that I try to listen to both sides, and when I say that, I go to one station who is totally biased against one way, and then another station, they're totally biased another way. It seems like I can see that easily. And so in what I would like to hear is not so much slamming the other sides all the time. I would like to see a person from a true opposite position, not just someone like, say, on a left-leaning station, have a kind of a left-leaning and then a kind of a right-leaning. I want the true side that's gonna like be able to talk to each other, opposite points of view to each other. Like, I think there's so many things that we more agree on, but we just can't talk about them, because if you say anything, you're like, say that if you talk about some problems with race, you're automatically a racist. If you talk, you can't talk about things anymore. For example, I think everybody wants law and order. I think everybody wants everybody to follow the same laws that we have on the books. So when I see it on one side, they're saying, oh, you're not being fair to the minorities. And the other side will say, well, honestly, it's the minorities that are breaking the law more often. And, you know, you can't ever get that conversation in a civil way to get to the all the different things that we have to discuss. It's always bashing just one side or the other and never talking about the issues. And it's so much that way on the different stations.
Yeah. And Leslie, we're running out of time. I'd like to get Ilya's comments on this. Civility. I think that's if we summed up what Leslie says there, we've lost the ability to make arguments without getting personal.
Yeah, I can certainly agree that civility is important. I think that sometimes what comes across as criticism of incivility is criticism of people who are angry, and sometimes people who are angry have a reason to be angry. I agree we shouldn't be name-calling each other. I won't get into the racial divide that, of course, is huge in this country that the caller alluded to, but I'm not sure if I could wave a magic wand and introduce one element into this equation. I'm not sure civility would be it. I think it would be willing to honestly and fair-mindedly listen to the opposing side, even if that side is saying things you really disagree with that you see as uncivil. We're all here. We have to get along with each other. And yes, civility is a part of that. But I think we have to establish what the facts are. And just to return again to the topic of our program here, we're having a real problem doing that. And once we get that, maybe we'll get somewhere on these debates. And hopefully we can also be civil to each other.
We've got about 40 seconds left. You're calling for an all-out offensive media literacy education. Give me the Cliff's Notes version of what you think that should look like.
I think it should be training children to, when they read any text, to look at, to establish whether the author of that text is being fair and honest, whether they're considering both sides of an issue, whether they are wrestling with the complexities of a problem rather than trying to present a simple, one-sided narrative that is trying to get people to share and like and click and not think. And I think it's really critical thinking that we're really missing, and we need it now more than ever. So please, let's do something about it. And thank you so much for hosting this program and for bringing this issue up with your audience.
Well, thank you for being here. I really appreciate the conversation, and all of our callers and emailers and Facebook posters, everybody contributed to the discussion this afternoon. It's been a good hour. Ilya Lazovsky is an editor for Foreign Policy magazine. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing the show and KP Whaley for on-air production. Tomorrow on the Ideas Network, some special programming. WPR presents the best of the Third Coast Audio Festival winners, which features the winners of the 16th annual radio documentary competition. Innovative and insightful, the stories will engage, provoke, entertain, and transport listeners, proving that all you need to discover new worlds is a little box and an antenna. And stay tuned after the news as we take a look at the mental health of college students and their growing reliance on resource centers on campus. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of WPR.